Good morning. You notice that since you didn't come to me, I'm coming to you. So we'll see how that works as we go through the meeting. I do send you greetings from the Lehman Avenue Church of Christ, and I'm grateful for the invitation to be here. The theme that was selected was Come to Jesus. And that, I believe, is always a timely theme. And when I heard that, certainly not only did I think of Matthew 11, verse 28 through 30, where Jesus offers that invitation in one of the teaching sections in the book of Matthew, but I think about various songs that we sing in our song books and our worship that are an appeal to come to Jesus. But the logical mind may ask, with such an invitation, maybe it would be good for me to ask why. Why should I come to Jesus? And so our various lessons that we'll be looking at together will center around some reasons why we should come to Jesus. And I think the very place for us to begin in the Bible class hour is to see how central Jesus is to that book that you either hold in your hand or you have on an app on your phone. As you see, come to Jesus because the Bible is His story. This being a Bible class, I'd like to begin, if you are accustomed to being interactive, by asking you a question. Why is it that people don't study their Bibles today like perhaps they did before? Would you agree that's a valid statement? People don't study their Bibles as they used to? Why would you say? Okay, they don't think it's real. So they know it's tangible, that you can hold it in your hand, but they don't think it is what it purports to be. That it's a product of men, not a product of God. That's where it's not the purpose of our study. We don't have the time in 45 minutes given our subject to look at this. But I would encourage you to look at some of the external disciplines of the Bible, to see how we got the Bible, to explore what's behind the idea of inspiration, God breathed, and how you can examine if a book holds up to those claims. Canonicity, how the Bible came together. Transmission, how through the copies that were made and how you look back to the original and you can see how with so many copies and such integrity from one to the other that this could not have been the product of man. And then, of course, translation, that you have a book God knew could go into all the languages of the world, almost 200 countries in the world, and the Bible has been translated into most of those languages. You can look at archaeology and how it supports. You can look at historical accuracy. You can look at geography, the various ways, messianic prophecy that would rebut that claim, but people don't hear that. And so they would say it's just something that men put together along the way, someplace far from here and away from here. And so our job is to kind of help them to build their faith in that book. But are there other reasons people give why they don't study their Bibles? Yes, sir. Yeah, sure. It's the information age. I don't know if y'all remember this. I'm old enough to remember when computers came along and the technology advanced about 15, 16, 17 years ago. Remember what they told us about these things right here? Man, all the time we were going to save, how it was going to shortcut everything in life. What's happened in that period of time? It's become a distraction. It's robbed us of a lot of time. And so we've only got so much time. 168 hours in a week. What are we going to do with that? And so often with the pressures of life, our work commitments, our families, we find ourselves in a situation where I just don't know where I'd fit it in because of other things that are distracting me. Any other reasons people give for not studying their Bibles?
Why should I?
Okay.
Why should I? I go to church every Sunday morning. I put in my time at church and I go home and continue the next week.
Okay, so now we're talking about religious people, and there are a great many who, despite that religiosity, don't really know what's going on inside the covers of the Bible. But they, you know what? I love my preacher. He's a great guy. We go fishing together. I trust him. He wouldn't lead me in the wrong direction, so I'll let him tell me what the Bible says. I'll come back the next week, and I'll keep doing that. And yet, my preacher won't stand for me in the judgment. I'll stand for myself. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. And so, there's a responsibility on me. What other reasons do people give? Yes, sir. Okay, so yeah, the Bible's a hard book to examine if you want to be your own boss, if you want to be the authority, because Scripture indicates that God is sovereign, He's transcendent, that is, He's above us, He's not subject to us, And He, as our Creator, has given us a will that we are to submit to. Laziness, I think we all fight that tendency in ourselves. There are some bad reasons. I also think that there's a good and legitimate reason. And that is, people say, I don't understand the Bible. I really just don't know how to make heads or tails of that. If we were to throw out several names this morning, people would say, I have no idea where they fit in the order of how the Bible reveals itself. And I really just don't know how to make top or bottom of it. You know, when people begin to study their Bibles, they're going to start in one of two places, maybe one of three, one of four places. They're going to either start in Matthew, the beginning of the New Testament. They're going to start in Psalms. And that's a good place to start, for it's devotional material. They'll start in Revelation, the very place you want to begin to understand the Bible, right? But most people will start in Genesis. It makes sense. It's the front of the book, and you're reading through. And here's what happens. You start reading in the book of Genesis, and it is written in narrative style. And so you have accounts that are you begin with one of the biggest questions of all. Where did I come from? And so God, from the very beginning, gives us that with the creation account. And you think about how riveting the book of Genesis is, carrying us through narrative after narrative. You have individuals like, of course, Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham. You work your way through the book of Genesis, and you have this Bible history unfolding. Such a great chunk of it, almost 2,000 years of it. And then you get to Exodus. How does Exodus begin? Anybody remember? Who's the hero of the book of Exodus? Moses. All right, so we have not only his birth, but you have his encounter with the great I Am at the burning bush. And then you have the bondage, and you have the 10 plagues, and you have the Exodus. You have Moses receiving the 10 commandments up on Mount Sinai. You have the covenant that God makes with the people. Of course, the golden calf in the middle of all of that. And then you get to Exodus 25 through 40, and you know what you're reading about? The tabernacle. And you have the dimensions, and you have the sizes, and the materials, and it's tedious. It really is. Then you get the book of Leviticus. And then you have all these laws, the Levitical laws. What do you do when you have leprosy and discharges? And what are the Levitical requirements? What are the different kinds of offerings and sacrifices? And again, it's tedious. You get to the book of Numbers. Now, there's narrative woven throughout some of these early books, but you get to Numbers, and that's the wilderness wandering period, and there is a good deal in between the numbering of the people. You have the faithlessness of the spies, and you have all the account of what happens in the wandering, and maybe you're reeled back in, but then you get to Deuteronomy, and it's the second giving of the law, and you're going through all of that piecemeal in 40 chapters, and most people by that point give up. They say, if I only understood how it all works together. I'm blown away with the density of the population in your part of the country, right here in the Omaha area. I witnessed this morning that there are at least three spots on your networks of programming put out by Churches of Christ. That's wonderful. There's your individual sphere of influence where you go every day and you encounter people. And I believe, especially since the pandemic, that people are hungry. They're looking for answers. They found that so much of what they thought they could rely upon and continue to think that they could rely upon is not so secure anymore. And so they're looking for answers. And if we can point them to the Bible and show them it is a divine product and help them to see how it all fits together, we might open hearts and minds to the gospel. And folks might desire more greatly to come to Jesus. What I want us to do, and I think I have till about 18 or 19 after, is to walk through the Bible. But before we do that, I heard people asking, what's this piece of paper that I have? If you didn't get a piece of paper, it's not a ticket to heaven, but it'd be helpful to this illustration. If you could tell me what it is you have in your hand. Who do I have to thank for handing those out? Is it you? I didn't get a chance to meet you back there. Did you hand those pieces of paper out? What's your name?
Paxton.
Paxton, I want to thank you for your help this morning. What do you have in your hands that Paxton handed to you? Okay, all right, very, very literal with that. What do you have on the paper there? Blue. All right, we got a color. Anybody anything different than blue? Trees, mountains. What else? Anything different from that? Snow? I must not have handed them all out. I thought there was a little bit more than that.
A lake.
A lake. All right, so we've got another feature. We've got mountains. We've got blue. We don't. You know, if yours is water or...
A cliff.
A cliff. All right, so we're beginning to see some features to come out. Anything different from what you've heard somebody else say? I think Miss Lane has the key piece there. She's got like four or five things on hers.
Yeah.
Sky.
I see a part of
a
puzzle.
Okay, so the philosopher in the room has poured forth here. It is. You are right, sir. It is a piece of the puzzle, and each of you have it. I don't know how many. There was a little paper cutter in here, and I chopped it several ways, and most of you should have gotten a piece of that. But what is it? What is that puzzle altogether? During the pandemic, my wife and I got our first chance. We lived in Denver for 13 years and never got to Glacier. But we went to Glacier in August of 2020, and what's this, Gooseneck Island or something like that, on the going to the road, the Sun Road, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen on earth. You see the snow on that mountaintop. You see that cliff coming down. You have all those pieces of the puzzle, and if we had the desire, we could go somewhere and we could fit all those together, and that's what you'd have. You'd have the whole picture.
Water.
And water is a part of that. That's exactly right. What if I were to say in Bible class this morning, somebody explained to me the purpose of the Bible using only the book of Obadiah? Would anybody want to take up that task? That's a piece of the puzzle. It's an inspired piece of the puzzle, the only one chapter book of the Old Testament, but it's not enough to give you the whole picture. How about Genesis? Could you explain the whole purpose of the Bible if that was the only piece that you had? It's foundational. The other 65 are built upon the truths that are taught there, but it's one, as significant as it is, it's one piece. How about the book of Acts? It's often called the hub of the Bible. If that was the only piece that you had, would that be enough for you to see the whole picture? You see, those 66 chapters make up that one book, the Bible. And when we begin to see it all together, whether you're in Genesis or Obadiah or Acts or Revelation or at any point in between, there is one theme being developed from beginning to end. And if we can see it all together and create a skeleton that we can look at and kind of get a grasp of the Bible, we can see exactly how it is appealing for us to come to Jesus. When we look at the Bible, we see that in one statement, we could say that the Bible is about the salvation of man through Christ to the glory of God. Wherever you're reading, that theme in some way is being unfolded. That the Bible is about the salvation of man. Well, if that's the truth, then what does that imply? If it's a book about salvation, what implication is there? Indeed, that's good thoughts. We're lost, right? There's no need for salvation if everybody's right with God. There are a lot of different places we could go. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 20 says, "There's not a just person upon earth that does good and does not sin." At the end of the Bible, John says in 1 John 5 and verse 19 that we know that the whole world is under the sway of the wicked one. But I think Romans, the magnus opus of Paul and his entire corpus, his 13 epistles, you have him saying at the very beginning of that book that this book he's writing about is dedicated to us knowing about the salvation that comes through Christ. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it is revealed the righteousness of God from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And right after that, in Romans 1, 18 through 32, he sets about to prove that Gentiles, and the church at Rome had Jews and Gentiles, that all Gentiles are lost. And when you think about that particular fact, you read through verse 18 through 32, you will find in the midst of that that the Gentiles were guilty of just about every conceivable sin that there is. Now, if we were to look at Romans 1, 18 through 32, we would find that it was true of the Roman Empire. It's true of our world today. Just walk through. There's the people who refuse to believe that God exists. In the first part of that, there are those who leave God's natural plan for sexuality, for an alternative plan. And then you have this long list of almost 25 individual sins. And Paul says that those who do such things are worthy of death. And there are those who approve of those who do those things. Paul's point in Romans 1, 18 through 32 is all Gentiles are sinners. Remember I said that there are Jews at the church at Rome? And what we could see later on in the book of Rome is you could almost hear those Jews in the background saying, "Amen, Brother Paul, you tell those sorry Gentiles what terrible sinners they are." But what does Paul do in Romans chapter 2? You who have the law, you're without excuse. If you say you shall not commit, you should not steal, do you steal? If you say you shall not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Paul says you have been given special revelation from God. You know better, but you are also guilty of that. So we're not surprised, are we, when we get to Romans chapter 3? And we have the conclusion of Paul in Romans 3 and verse 10. There is none righteous, no, not one. We all know what Romans 3:23 says, right? For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Now let's listen to what Paul is saying. In my past, I have a sin struggle. In my accountable past, I struggle with sin. Is that true? How about now? Maybe, you know, what I have found, I'm 54 years old, that the struggles change as you go through life. And you focus your energy on striving, as Paul would in Romans chapter 7, to do what God says you ought to do, and you fall short and you work on those areas of life and you conquer those more or less, not perfectly, but what happens? There are other areas of life. And so Paul is indicating in Romans 3 what the rest of the Bible is saying, that the Bible exists as a mirror, James chapter 1, for me to see my spiritual condition. The Bible is about the salvation of humanity, but it comes through Christ. When you are looking at the Bible historically, you're seeing it as His story. So as we walk through the rest of this lesson, we're going to see that the Bible is devoted to that theme, to the story of Jesus from eternity to eternity, and that time in between when He comes to this earth to be our substitute sacrifice. I would just point you to John chapter 4. The first time Jesus openly confesses that He is the Messiah, in John chapter 4, to the Samaritan woman at the well, you notice a progression, a change in her view of Him as being a man, a Jewish man, to being a teacher, to being a prophet, to finally being the Messiah. And she says, as she leaves her water pot behind and goes back to Sychar, her village, she says, "Come and see a man who's told me everything that I've ever done." Jesus goes and spends a few days in that village, and the people, as they encounter Jesus with an open heart, they say, "Now we know, not because of this woman's testimony, but of ourselves, that this is the Messiah." John chapter 4 in verse 42, when honest hearts come face to face with the Jesus of the Bible, they come to the same conclusion. The Bible is devoted to the theme of our salvation through the person of Jesus to the glory of God. Wish we had time to look at that more deeply. One of the great themes of the Bible, God created us so that we could see in this universe, to see His glory, for us to understand the nature of our Maker. But how is it that God could be glorified through our obedient response? I don't know that anybody knows this. Well, I think Gary and Elaine know this. But Friday at 3 o'clock, we had our third grandchild. I was worried that she was going to be born while I was over here. But all three of them, and we had none January 1st of last year. We've got three now. And we've only used two of our sons in order to get to that result. But this is the first granddaughter. We had to watch Rich, the older brother, while they were giving birth. He's this close to on his own saying, "I love you. I can't wait for the day." Not, of course, we're prompting them, right? We're telling them how to form the words. And maybe the first time it's going to be parenting. But do you remember when you were a parent and your child of their own volition came up to you for the first time and said, "I love you"? God created us sinlessly. He created us in His image. And sin brings reproach to God, but when we of our own volition come to Him and strive to live in obedience to Him, He is glorified. The Bible is written to develop that theme. And so what I want to do in the next few minutes is for us to build an outline of that so that we can have something we can anchor to understand ourselves as we grow in our knowledge, but also something that we can share with others so that they can understand one of the big impediments, and that is, I just don't understand this book. All right, so as we start in the very beginning, we see that the Messiah is needed. Genesis 1:1 through chapter 3 in verse 14, God creates man in sinless perfection, that is without sin, in fellowship with Him, in a paradise in which they are intended to be. There's no reason for us to believe otherwise, but that would be forever. And yet He gave man the ability to choose. And if you want to remember the events of Genesis 1 through chapter 3, there's five words to remember. There's the people of Genesis 1 through 3. Who are the people? Adam and Eve. They're in a place. Garden of Eden. There is a precept, a prohibitive precept. What is that? Don't eat of any of the trees, right? I'm just trying to check and see if you're awake here at 9:55. No. Can they eat of the trees? There's an exclusion. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God wants man to have the ability of free will. All right, so you have a precept. Then you have a penalty. But God tells them ahead of time what would be the cost of disobedience. What is it? Death. And then there's a presumption. Man partakes. 1 Timothy 2:8-15, Eve is deceived. Adam goes along with her in that. So I want you to think about it this way, that before sin occurs, and there's certainly so much more to say about all of this, but for the sake of time, the Messiah is needed because after that sin, that presumption, that separation occurs, James 2:24-26, and now there's this separation between man and God. And the question is, what can man do to reconcile that situation? Not a thing. Oh, you say, well, be obedient. Yes, but what about that sin that has already occurred? How does man take care of that? He cannot of himself. God is going to have to provide a solution. God is going to have to build a bridge whereby man can respond and be made right with God. And that's what the rest of the Bible is devoted to. So you have the Messiah is promised. In Genesis chapter 3, you have God giving an account. And I don't know how you hear what happens in Genesis chapter 3 after sin. God pursues Adam and Eve. There's no trace of in the text of anger, but certainly there's hurt. And He goes and He asks Adam a question, "Where are you?" Certainly for Adam's benefit, God is omniscient. Adam begins to reflect on that. And in that the process of asking those questions, God asks him what he's done. You remember what Adam does? Adam takes responsibility, doesn't it, for his sin that he commits? Doesn't he say, "It was me, I was wrong"? What does he say? "It was her fault. And Lord, it's really your fault because it was the woman you gave me." He moves on to the woman. He doesn't even dignify that with a response. And at least somebody in that family owns up to their sin, right? What does Eve say? Serpent. That's where we are in Genesis 3:15. God is speaking to the serpent and says, "I'm going to put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, and it shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." All right, so as we would look at the rest of history, beginning with Genesis 4 and 5 and allusions like Revelation 12 and verse 9, looking back on this, we see that the devil is involved in this, that serpent of old. And we see that there is an enmity that's going to be fulfilled, it seems, at the cross when Christ is defeated in death, but for that brief period of time. And He arises from the dead, Hebrews 2:14-15, and destroys him who had the power of death. God's made a promise. You've broken promises because you're human. God's perfect. He cannot. And so His character, His nature is on the line. He makes a promise that He is going to build a bridge. And that's the rest of the book of Genesis. I know you're thinking we're not going to get this done, but we will. We have the messianic genealogies. God is building the bridge that will get us back to a restored relationship with God. And so when you go through Genesis 4 and 5, you have planks on the bridge. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. These generations are playing out historically, getting us ever closer to Christ. Go to Luke chapter 3 and you'll see that this is part of the messianic genealogies that goes all the way back to Adam. And so God is keeping his word. Messianic means of the Messiah or the Savior. Genealogy is just the family tree. So Genesis 4 and 5 gives us that. And then, of course, we have the messianic line preserved in Genesis 6 through 9. Who's the hero? Genesis 6 through 9. Noah. God's always the hero. That's a good point. In Noah's day, what were things like? What was the world like in Noah's day? Evil? Horrible? All right, let's use Bible terms. That the thoughts and the intentions of man's heart was only evil continually. Is it that bad today? Before you, okay, sometimes I see some heads yes, some heads no. Let's hope it's not that bad, because how many folks got on the ark? Eight? I think we got a few more than that in this room this morning, but it is getting worse. Certainly, probably we would say it's worse than it's ever been in our lifetime. But in those toward those difficult times, Noah was able to persuade and to lead his family to get in God's place of safety. God makes a promise that he's going to build a bridge to get us back to him. Even in the midst of great wickedness, when God was sorry that he made man, he had one who demonstrates faithful obedience. He's in, of course, the faith chapter, Hebrews 11 and verse 7. But what we'll notice here is a concept that we need to challenge. People who don't know the Bible and make assumptions, even though they've not read it, they'll say, you know, the God of the Old Testament is a God of fill in the blank. God of wrath, justice, holiness, vengeance. How about the God of the New Testament? He's a God of what? Love, mercy, kindness, grace, understanding. Is that right? It's half right, isn't it? How about the God of the New Testament? Is he a God of justice, a God of wrath? Ask Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. How about the God of the Old Testament? One of the significant things we read in Genesis 6 is that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah's not perfect. Look at Genesis chapter 9. And yet he's obedient. God gives him, I believe it's 13 commands in Genesis chapter 6. He obeys every one of them. God has told him, here's the place of safety. God keeps his promise. So much we could see from that. When we teach Noah in our Bible schools, let's be New Testament in that. New Testament writers were. They taught the judgment, baptism, preaching, faith, using Noah. But then we have the messianic genealogies in Genesis 10 and 11, tracing through Shem. Shem are Faxad, Selah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, and Abraham. God is fulfilling his promise that he's going to provide a Savior. And we see that unfolding historically. That's what the Bible's doing for us. And then we have the messianic genealogies, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God makes promises to Abraham. And you can boil it down to two. I'm going to make of you a great nation, and out of your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. God's making two promises. He's going to keep them because he's a perfect God. And so he sets about to fulfill the first promise of a nation. You need probably at least three things for there to be a nation, right? What do you have to have for a nation to exist? People, territory, and law. So guess what? The next things are covered in the Bible. In this order, you have the people. They go from 70 in Joseph's household to the numbering at the beginning of the book of Numbers, north of 600,000, and so they're flourishing. You see in Exodus chapter 1, so you have the people. And we've already talked about what happens in this period of time. After the 10th plague, Pharaoh lets the people go, and they leave. They observe the Passover. They go up, and in Exodus chapter 20, we have the messianic nation being formed by way of law, the Ten Commandments. And the laws that are made that we see throughout the rest of the, what we call the Pentateuch, the five books of the Old Testament, the law books. Then we have the messianic nation by way of the territory. The book of Joshua, you have the faithless spies in the book of Numbers. That generation passes away except for Joshua and Caleb, and they go in and they conquer that land that God promised Abraham. And so in Joshua, we have the first promise fulfilled. We have a messianic nation that is the vehicle, Galatians 3, through whom Jesus is going to eventually come. We have the messianic nation by way of territory. You've got your nation. Then we have the Messianic nation before it becomes a kingdom. 300 plus years. Some say up to 400 years, the period of the judges. And really, if you were to describe the period of the judges, what would you say? There was a statement that characterized that entire period. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Sometimes read, the first time that is Judges 17:6. The second time is Judges 21:25. And read, if you have the stomach, what happens in between those two. What happens when people do what's right in their own eyes? But despite the fact they have no earthly monarch, which the book of Deuteronomy says that God anticipated and knew was going to take place, despite the fact that they don't have the military might of some of the others around them now after the book of Joshua, because of that common heritage and faith, they hold together providentially. Because God's building a bridge to bring man back to him. You have the Messianic nation by way of the kingdom. In that period of the judges, you start with Othniel and you end with Samuel. In 1 Samuel 8 and verse 6, they come up to him and they say, "Your sons, Samuel, aren't living right. And OPS, by the way, all the nations around us have a king and we want to be like them." Samuel takes that personally, but God says, "They haven't rejected you, they've rejected me. Give them what they want." And this starts a period of the United Kingdom. It lasts 120 years. There are three kings, right? Who are they? Saul, David, Solomon. They're united. And you read about that, by the way, from 1 Samuel chapter 9 through 1 Kings chapter 12. This is also the time when Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon are written. I believe the book of Job belongs to the patriarchal period and probably fits historically in the book of Genesis. All right, you have the United Kingdom. But you have a division that takes place. Whose fault is the division? It's man's. Who specifically? Okay, so Rehoboam's the immediate reason. There's an underlying reason spiritually behind that. Solomon. Why is this man on earth? You remember in Deuteronomy, one of the things that God said you're not to multiply? Wives. Because they'll take your heart away from me. What does he do? 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 11, I should say. They pull him away. And as a result of that, God sends the prophet to say, because of your father David, I'm going to preserve a part of the kingdom for you, but I'm going to tear the rest of it away. And by the way, he sends another prophet to Jeroboam and says, I'm going to give this to you. And if you'll be faithful to me, then your kingdom will last forever. But of course, we know he was so bad that every king in the Israelite kingdom, the northern kingdom, it was said of him at the end of his reign that he did just like Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. So we have the United Kingdom followed by the divided kingdom. Rehoboam was the immediate cause. Rehoboam, this is not a political statement, but here's what happened. Solomon had to raise taxes in order to build the temple. And so after that, Solomon's counselors came to him and said, if you'll lower that, then the people will love you. He said, let me think about that. And then he has his peers come and they say, you make your pinky like your father's loins. You show them who's boss. You really tighten the screws. And so he sends out his tax collector. Remember what happens to him? He's killed. And then they say, we have no inheritance in David. And so they go up into the northern kingdom and it divides. You have the Israelite kingdom, the northern kingdom. You have the southern kingdom of Judah. How many righteous kings up north? Do you remember approximately? Zero. None. They all do evil. And so we have that divided kingdom in 2 Kings. Let me go back to that. I'm glad you showed me that other button. 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings 17, you have the divided kingdom in which God sends some of his greatest writing and non-writing prophets. He sends Elijah and Elisha and Micaiah, but he also sends Isaiah, Hosea, Joel, Jonah, Amos, and Micah pleading with Israel, come back to me. They never do. And so in the 8th century, 722 BC, God sends the Assyrians from the northeast. They come in, they take Israel, they destroy them, and 10/12 of the kingdom is gone. God's still building a bridge to get us ever closer to Christ. His promise is still intact. With the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Benjamin, you have God's people persisting. So we have that divided kingdom wherein now we have Judah alone. This is the rest of the Old Testament. Through the historical books, you have 2 Kings 17 through 2 Chronicles 36. And in the rest of the Bible, you can divide the rest of it into three parts. And it all centers around the Babylonian Empire. It's before, during, and after Babylon. So before Babylon, you have the kingdom of David, starting with Rehoboam and going all the way down to Jehoiakim. You have a few righteous kings. You have Asa, Jehoshaphat, you have Hezekiah, Josiah, who try to get the people to come back, but mostly they don't. So before Babylon, you have Jeremiah, Obadiah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah written to plead with them to come back to God. Ultimately, they're going farther away from him, and so in 606 B.C. to 536 B.C., you have 70 years of Babylonian captivity. During that time, Ezekiel and Daniel are written. Ezekiel and Daniel look ahead to when Judah will come back to their land, never to own it again, but they'll occupy it. But you know what? Ezekiel and Daniel look even further down the road. You know what they see, both of them? The time of the Messiah. When the Messiah is going to come, that bridge-building project in its consummation. And then you have Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, who are leading a restoration movement. Get back to God. Rebuild the law, or restore the law, rebuild the wall, rebuild the temple. And so all of that's what happens in the rest of the Old Testament, preparing themselves for the coming of God. They preserve the law. This is where the various sects like the scribes and the Pharisees come along through the synagogue teaching in which they can preserve the prophecies. They're looking ahead for the Messiah. And then you have the Messianic kingdom between the Testaments. It's that little blank space between Malachi and Matthew. But I suggest that it's covered in the Bible. Daniel 7 through 12 looks ahead to this time when these successive empires are going to come. You're going to have the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. Daniel says, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. It shall break in pieces all these other kingdoms. It will not be left to other peoples, but it will itself endure forever. He's referring to that kingdom which Christ came to establish. In Matthew 16, 18, and 19, he says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. We could trace that through and see how we see on the day of Pentecost when Christ is preached, those promises being fulfilled in that particular prophecy. But then we have the Messiah comes, Matthew through John. All that we've been building toward in this class, it's not really biographies. It deals with his ministry, but it gives us his virgin birth, his eternal nature, John chapter 1, his perfect sinless life, his vicarious death, that is, he died in our place, his burial, his resurrection, his 40 days of appearance, his ascension into heaven, and his being seated at the right hand of the throne of God. What we have been anticipating, what God had been pointing toward throughout the revelation of history, is culminated in the perfect life of Jesus Christ, to whom we are to come. Now a bridge has been built, paved with blood, where we can come back to God. Then we have the Messianic kingdom, the church. In Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, you have the blueprint for the book of Acts. You'll be my witnesses, beginning in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth. You have the church established in Acts 1 through 9, where it goes to the Jews. You have the church expanded in Acts 10 through 28, when the gospel goes to the Gentiles, to everybody, God's intention for all to be saved through Christ. Then you have the Messianic kingdom and how you live your life therein. The epistles, Romans through Jude. If Christ is king and we're in a spiritual kingdom, then how are we to behave ourselves as citizens? That's what those books are devoted to helping us. It's written to churches and to individuals. And then we have the Messianic kingdom, its eternal destiny. John sees this grand vision on the Isle of Patmos. And he says, in essence, I have seen the end and we're going to win. The message of Revelation, not to oversimplify it, is that those who overcome, those in the church, will be overcomers. They get to come over into heaven. I realize that the greatest scholars that have ever lived will dig and dig and dig and never get to the depth of God's perfect inspired word. But we have a skeleton, kind of some of the pieces of the puzzle that we can put together, and we can put meat on those bones. And as we do, it's not just for our edification and for our knowledge. It's meant for us to share. so that others can come to understand. And I believe if that impediment is removed, there's so many good people that we know who are searching for answers if they just understood it better. If we can help them with that, then think about how it's going to impact and change eternity. You have listened very kindly. I don't know if I've gone over or not, but if I have, I'm sorry about that. We'll make it up maybe somewhere down the line. Thank you very much for your attention. We'll be dismissed.